Well, I think we should get started, and I think our
conference
tells us it is about time. Some people, I suppose, might end up trickling in here. This is my first 8:30 session, so I don't know if people are likely to be more or less timely. Good evening.
Good evening.
Great to see this bigger crowd. My name is Allison Lee. I am an English professor. I teach literature at California Lutheran University in Thousand Oaks, California. Some of you might recognize my family name. Anyone who's been here over the years has run into either my parents, David and Karen, or my uncles and aunts, Dan, Chris, Morris, Christine, my sister Rebecca, my brother Jonathan. We've all been in and out of this place many a time, and it's my pleasure to be, for the first time, asked to be on the summer teaching staff here. I first lived here as a 10-year-old, which was awesome. It's a great age to be at Holden Village for an extended period of time. I was alert enough to really take in the principles and sort of impact of being here in a really rich way. But I was also a cook for a couple of years, from 91 to 93. One of the things that I have always liked about Holden, and that I'm sure is a part of what brings many of us back here, is the way in which it is designed and or is just inevitably, by virtue of what it is, a place where all of us are challenged and invited to be all kinds of things. There's a lot of room here to figure out what kind of task you want to do, to figure out where your skills lie. Sort of anyone who's willing to do something usually can do it. And there's not the strange expectation that the person in thus and such a role looks like or is like a certain kind of person. There's certainly women who are mavericks who go around pounding nails into things and carrying things because women can carry things. And you could go down a whole long list of tasks and think about the ways in which Holden just doesn't really seem to bat an eye at who is doing what around here. You can have women or men in charge of your session, women or men leading worship, women or men washing your clothes or hanging things out to dry. And I think that it's really one of the gifts that we all end up with, whether we think we're coming here for that reason or not, is that we can try anything we want and see what we think of it and not have some kind of idea that maybe that's awkward. I don't know what this past winter's winter community was up to. You just never know, but one of the winters I was here in 91, everyone was knitting their faces off. The whole village was just a knitting bonanza. And at every staff meeting, at every time that anyone sat down, everyone was knitting. The men were knitting, the women were knitting, the old, the young. I tried to knit. I knit, I believe, a square. Had really good intentions of being a scarf. But even in its existence as a square, was kind of pulled into more of a parallelogram shape. Couldn't quite get the tensions right. It was not a thing I took to, like a fish taking to water, let's just say. But I was just sort of excited every time I was at Vespers or something, sitting up there and looking down, and everybody's hands were busy doing this. And, it struck me that it seemed a bit unusual or not the usual thing to see men's hands with knitting needles, with rugged fingers, and, people had gone around pounding nails into things all day and were making these beautiful. Almost all of the men knit far more than a square, and I was really pleased about that. So I've been asked to talk this week, and I was here on teaching staff last week. A few of you are layover folks, about diversity in literature. So I'm borrowing from my literary toolbox, I guess, as an English professor, but also drawing from my experience as a person maybe a little outside the core of ideals of femininity. I was that kid who could never get the hairdressers in the small town in Minnesota where I grew up would never cut my hair short enough because I would say that I really wanted to have short hair like a boy's and they would cut it to my shoulders like a bob. And that was short hair for a girl. And I was just always an infuriated small child that my hair was not quite what I wanted it to be. So I grew up in a family where my parents and extended family, these uncles, these aunts, these grandparents, were people who identified from before I was born as feminists. And for them, that definition meant that they were interested in valuing women and women's activities and skills in an equal fashion to men's. And in the 60s, when I was born, and in the 70s when I was young, there was definitely a sense that this was something that should be looked at, that statistically, when you look at the people who are teaching in schools or powerful political roles or, you know, sort of social agents, they were usually men and not women, and my folks were of a kind of people who thought that we should give some attention to that. So I grew up in a family that did not bug me about the fact that I wanted to have short hair like a boy's. That was just how I described it, and I had to come back from the hairdressers and my mother would get out her scissors and try to make some improvements. At any rate, I grew up with a certain perspective on gender that I attribute in large part to my family's view of what it meant for them to be people interested in social equality and social justice. Last week, my topics were along the lines of skin privilege and class privilege and able-bodiedness, and this week I'm taking a lens more to gender and sexuality and actually the environment, which I pose as a question. Is that part of our social diversity frame or not? So here we are tonight to talk about men and women and the rest of us. I thought it was kind of funny. And actually, in light of what I'm planning to have us talk about today and the exercise that I'm going to have us undertake in a few minutes, I would tend to say that most of us are the rest of us in that equation. And I throw that down as a bit of a gauntlet at the moment for us to think about, and we'll see where our conversation might lead by the end of our hour. Let me pause at the moment and read for you a poem. Given this, here comes the literature portion, one part of the literature element here. I study 19th century British literature as one of my fields of emphasis. I study and teach a lot of different things, but I'd like to read you a sonnet by a British poet named Christina Rossetti, whom many of you probably know, very well known, very popular writer, both in her own time in the mid to late 19th century and to this day. She was a religious person and had very high standards about who she wanted to meet. I believe she was engaged for a time, but then broke the engagement because the gentleman that was interested in her was not high church enough. And she wrote a lot of social tracts and journals and things of religious nature also. But as a single woman in the mid to late 19th century, gender is a topic that comes up for her in a lot of her poems. And this is very brief and one I have always liked. It is called In an Artist's Studio. And she's thinking here of a painter. Her brother, Dante Gabriel Rossetti, was both a painter and a poet. and was one of the group of painters some of you might remember from an art history class long ago, known as the Pre-Raphaelites in England. So she was very close with a lot of people who were both writers and painters and thinking about art and its textures. So this is a fictional story, but the speaker has entered the studio of a painter. One face looks out from all his canvases. One self-same figure sits or walks or leans. We found her hidden just behind these screens. That mirror gave back all her loveliness. A queen in opal or in ruby dress. A nameless girl in freshest summer greens. A saint, an angel. Every canvas means the same one meaning, neither more nor less. He feeds upon her face by day and night, and she, with true kind eyes, looks back on him, fair as the moon and joyful as the night, as the light, not wan with waiting, not with sorrow dim, not as she is, but was when hope shone bright. Not as she is, but as she fills his dream. Yikes. Seems so lovely for a minute. And then you have this face feeder. tell me a little bit, I'm interested just in a few subjective responses to that. What do you notice or what do you think about? Like or dislike?
I think that's our society. I mean, it's all about appearance.
Could you repeat it? I didn't hear that.
It's all about,
all about our society and it's all about appearances. I mean, the media and...
Yeah. This, in the very short space, the artist, in words, constructs a situation where the viewer is painting characters, all kinds of characters, but they aren't looking like the model, right? This is the kind of painter, this is before cameras, and there's a live model sitting while the painter paints, right? And somehow the painter is painting this idea, his ideal of a female figure, not as she, the woman in the room, is, wan with waiting, dim with sorrow. She once was alive and joyful when hope was bright, but somehow the viewer is not seeing the real person anymore, has sort of taken on this idea of beauty or whatever it is that the viewer wants to see in her. And this is a very persistent issue. I think one of the reasons I like 19th century writers is because students, people tend to think they're old-fashioned, and they're very present concerns in them.
I might have misheard at the beginning, but there was a piece about a mirror, so that I was led to believe that in some sense he was painting a self-portrait in the form of a woman.
Ah, well, that's interesting. I think in this first quatrain, the speaker is in the first person. There's a we. We found these canvases. So there's a sense that there's an auditor in the poem, that the speaker's gone back to the studio with someone new and is sort of pointing around and saying, we found her stacked up behind here. We found her hidden behind these screens, and that mirror gave back her loveliness. So I imagine, I'm no visual artist. I draw like 8-year-old stick figures when I try to draw things for my students on the board. But I imagine, if any of you are painterly, that if you're looking at a 3-dimensional figure and painting, you might have a mirror set up near the body to help you with the 3-dimensional views or angles or something like that. But certainly the issue of mirroring is brought into this. You know, are we looking at a real person? Or are we looking at a reflection of a person? Or are we looking at something that exists in our minds even beyond that reflection?
Well, they're both projecting. The artist is projecting, but also the writer is projecting.
Mm-hmm. This is, the writer is imagining what has happened, is an interpreter of these images. And then there's another layering where we, the reader, has to interpret the scene that is set. It becomes a very delightful puzzle, in a way, to sort of look at how all these different layers become pretty rich pretty quickly. Thanks. There's a hand up over here.
Yeah, I'd have to read it again, but I was just putting together those two comments about appearances. And I guess I was thinking the painter knew the person, because it sounded like he was trying to paint the person who was more alive before, like perhaps before something tragic happened and she became a more somber person or more, you know. And so when the line was that the mirror reflected her true beauty or whatever, I saw the canvas as being the mirror. But that's what he captured. That was the mirror that he would remember. But that was just an interpretation.
No, I think that's really helpful. And certainly this is why it's great to read poems over and over again. A good poem will give back more the more attention you give to it. You can't just read it like the newspaper and whisk over it and think you've got it. It's not just giving us a little bit of data that we then know and move on. This bears looking at and sort of sifting through a little bit. Because we know quite a bit about Christina Rossetti and Dante Gabriel Rossetti, we have enough information to suggest that this is, in fact, Christina Rossetti's brother and the woman he loved, who he did not marry for a long time. He had a long-standing affair with her. And so we can get through this message that once upon a time her hope was bright. And I think what the poem suggests, although we can't be sure, that the idea of a tragic event happening elsewhere that she's now more somber is more of a reach, and what's closer by is the fact that she's been sitting there in the studio hour after hour, day after day, maybe week after week or month after month while he's obsessed with painting, you know, and they're in a relationship. And I don't know, at a certain point, I would like to not just be painted as an ideal by my partner, but I might want to hang out with that person, maybe, you know, have a little physical something or other, rather than the space of a studio and to be asked to be still. So she said this idea that the figure is wan with waiting, it begs the question, what is she waiting for? You know, she's... a little bit of this sense of, hello, you know, I was 18 when we started and now I'm like 42 and you've got some gray hairs here and when are we going to get a move on? Just please.
Again, I would want to read it again, but I did pick up that the image of the woman is quite innocent. She's angelic.
Mm-hmm.
And there was some other...
A queen, a nameless girl, a saint, and an angel.
A saint and an angel.
Are the images.
So very innocent, and mm-hmm. again, not multidimensional, really, at all.
Yeah, that's a really good point. They are roles. They are social roles. In a couple different places in the social fabric where women might exist. A queen, a child who's nameless. I don't know how important that is to us as we think about it. But then a saint or an angel, you know, those aren't even real women, right? Those are female figures, you know, but the goddess Nike or the city Roma is not an actual person. It's a stylized thing, an angel, a saint. I don't know, maybe someone here is a saint. I'm speaking too soon. But,
Lutherans, we're all saints.
Indeed. We are a priesthood of all believers.
Could it be possible that it was more than, I got the impression it was more than one painting.
Yes.
And that all these paintings had this same image
yes.
in it. And it wasn't just the one painting.
Yes.
Everything he painted had... this face reflecting out, that mm-hmm. it was this image in his head that he was reflecting out.
mirror of what he wanted, but it wasn't just one painting, there was multiple paintings.
Yeah.
And every one had like the same eyes or the same reflection.
Yep. That's exactly right. And if you had this in front of you, I just eschewed the whole electronic. I guess I could have put this on an overhead and we could have looked at it, but that seemed complicated for one poem. But yeah, the opening line, one face looks out from all his canvases. So we definitely get the sense that this is just repetition. This is, you know, you could Photoshop, you know, you click out, you know, whichever beautiful woman you like, and then you just kind of cut and paste her on top of all the pictures of you, you know, or you get this idea that this is like the really old-fashioned Photoshop. I gotta paint every time, but I'm gonna paint the same thing over and over again. Well, I love this poem, and there's a lot to talk about, but what I want to draw on for a moment and to invite you in is to think about these ideals. This is obviously a sense of an idealized female figure for this particular artist. And we walk through the world, whether we like it or not, with all kinds of gender ideals pressing down upon us. Right? That we can all, whether we ourselves are male or female, can probably pretty quickly rattle off a list of what an ideal man and an ideal woman ought to be like. In some sense, you know, I'm not exactly sure whose sense this is, right? Ideology is troubling this way. It just kind of exists out there. But one way or another, we're bombarded with messages all day long from the day we're born about men and about women, and certainly with some value judgments made about expectations, right? So what I want to take a few minutes to do is to just generate lists about sort of ideal men and ideal women. And I guess maybe if I could have one person write the idea from this morning, they have two people writing. Would you like to make
one?
You want to write about ideal men or women? I'll make the other list.
I'll do about women.
Okay. So if you could just, I guess we're probably going to end up with fairly long lists, and they certainly won't be complete, but we'll try to write medium, small. Let's just holler out some ideas, some expectations, some descriptors of...
Men are strong and women are soft.
Great start. Yes, please.
Women are beautiful.
Men are handsome.
Handsome, yeah.
Can we mess with the ideology, or do you want us to do the stereotypes?
These are ideals. The like stereotype certainly is a more pejorative term, but you know we all know, you know, men are from Mars and women are from Venus, right? That kind of, let's have a list over here, list over here.
Women are caring.
Mm-hmm.
Nurturing.
That's right.
And men are protecting.
Great.
Men are providers.
Providers, great.
Caretakers,
good word.
Women are demure and men are direct.
Oh, nice word. Yeah, you'll impress an English professor by using those words that aren't the same 100 words that everyone uses all day long. Demure.
Women are creative and men are always looking.
That's an interesting pairing. I just have to agree. We're not quite.
Men are logical and women are emotional.
Okay. Yeah. Ooh. We're already like uncomfortable, right? That's fine. That's totally fine for the purpose of it.
Men don't cry.
Mm-hmm. This is a big one. Thanks.
Men can fix things.
Sure they can.
And open jars.
Just like women that... Yep.
open jars.
That's
strong.
Yes.
And God help them if they can, right? Man, you lose your license right there. You can't get the jar open.
Women are homemakers.
Okay.
Women are emotional.
Do we? Oh,
right
yep.
here.
Yep.
Men never ask for directions.
four, we know where we're going.
Always depict the man as the stupid one and the woman as the problem solver and the bright one in the family.
This is really interesting. Yeah, our current sitcoms are doing something a little different than we might expect, right? Mm-hmm. Sloppy doofus, beautiful, you know, slim, sharp person, and then there are all kinds of laughs and hijinks about that.
Yeah, you know, right? What did you see in this guy in the first place?
Right. And yet somehow she has endless patience.
Yes.
And this is really interesting. I'm going to put this a little bit in brackets because this is a trend that is a little bit outside some of what we've been more persistent or longer standing ideals in the second half of, I'd say, the
there used to be a program,
century.
Father Knows Best, doctor, whatever. And now it's just the total reverse.
Yeah, okay.
Marge Simpson knows that.
Oh, women are all socialites and talkative, and men are more introverted.
Okay, the quiet...
Women are all talkative, how about that?
Well, extrovert versus introvert, yeah. Women as gossipers.
I'm going to put strong and silent up here because that's just kind of a phrase we know, right?
What was
the strong and silent type?
Women are talking.
Gossipers. Yeah.
Gossipers.
That's a word that we would seldom see attached to a male person, although begs the question.
Men like sex and women don't.
Aha! Yeah. I think you can put over here sex question mark exclamation point. This is just the exclamation point. Right?
Sex. Can we get in there the results of that sex? Because I think that women are seen as responsible for the child, the resultant children.
Mm-hmm. Maternal,
bearing them and raising them and nurturing them.
Mothering.
Yeah.
Yep.
That's very maternal. There's a very strong maternal that men don't.
Maternal.
Yeah, if we were making these lists sort of trying to do kind of the inverse of each thing, that would probably be across from the providers, right, in terms of family role. You go get the money, right, you go look after the kids.
And housekeeping, too. I mean, you know, it's
homemakers. I have homemakers.
Yeah. All right, a few more things, and then we've got a pause. We could make these for an eternity, right? Yeah.
It's really hard for me to say, but there's an image that men, well, I teach high school. Girls aren't supposed to be smart, boys are smart.
Ah.
Not 100%, but there's that.
Well, not smarter than a guy.
Yeah, I don't like smart
girls.
But besides maternal, women have babies.
They have babies, yes, that's for sure. And that's an ideal, right? If women don't have babies, at a certain point, people start... You start feeling like you're wrong somehow, right? You get all more and more questions, you know. What are you thinking? You're carrying a womb, you know.
You become a spinster.
Yeah, exactly.
You become a spinster if you don't.
Ah, uh-huh. Childless equals spinster over there. What do we call childless men?
Bachelor.
Yeah.
Lucky.
Woo! To a few basketball players, and these are great lists. Thank you for writing.
Sure.
We can certainly add some more if we need to, just within our time here. But we're already chuckling because I think the kind of person that shows up at a kind of place like Holden, you know, has this idea that these are awfully narrow, awfully restrictive, right? And we have this sense, I don't even want to say it, right? It's like, oh, it's so awful to, to name the kinds of ideas that do float around out there and that do persist, maybe not in every single person's mind, but they are out there in our culture. And we end up being people who, because they exist, we are always in relationship to these lists somehow. We are either adhering to them in certain ways, or we are stepping outside them. But in either case, these things are still out there, right? These things are still just, people kind of know them. And then we sometimes, it's all too easy to draw our measure of people at a glance by virtue of how far or near, you know, what the divergence is between the person you encounter and this list. And that seems to be one of the things that I want us to sort of make visible here, is that whether or not we're thinking about it every minute, you know, I don't go down the street with these things like in a checklist that I'm always looking at and then interacting. They're kind of in us. They get into our fabric a little bit.
Well, and when you don't fit that Mars-Venus thing, I mean, in my family, I'm the Mars. You know, my husband's the other way around. And it's, you feel, I don't know, wrong. You know, you feel wrong because you're not, even though logically you know that's perfectly an okay way to be,
yeah,
it doesn't feel that way all the time.
Yeah, yeah. Well, these are the kinds of things I want to get us to talk about. I have a handful of questions about these lists. And before I question you, I just, because I'm an English professor, I just want to talk about connotations for a minute. We all know what connotations of words are, right? There's a literal meaning of a word, right? Bachelor equals unmarried guy. That's just a literal definition. But bachelor also comes with some connotations, right? Some suggestions that accrue to that word that we all kind of know when we see the word. Anyone want to toss out some connotations?
Playboy.
Yeah.
Partier.
Partier.
Especially when you add the tag professional bachelor.
Ah, yeah, yeah. That's a carefully constructed guy, right? Yeah. Yeah.
Bachelor of Arts, I never understood.
A swinger.
Swinger. Yeah. Sounds kind of fun, right?
Somebody who runs from responsibility.
Ooh, that sounds
free.
A little more a negative judgment, yeah.
Or a catch.
Yeah.
Liberated.
Well, so let's look at what might be an across the aisle similar word, the word spinster came up, right?
Old maid. Mm-hmm.
Wrinkled.
Any other connotations for spinster?
The man with their cats.
Lonely. Oh, cats, right? And how many are we talking? The connotation of spinster with cats equals...
Men.
Oh, we're in double digits instantly, right? Yeah. Oh, gosh. I only have two. So don't get any ideas, all right? I have not created a child, and I have two cats. So, yeah, I'm in a position where, you know, there are going to be people who are going to think certain things that are not so kind or generous toward me because of those kinds of ideas, right? I'd rather be a bachelor than a spinster, but I don't get to have that word, right? Because that's a male word. Except,
bachelorette.
Yeah, yeah. The et. What happens when you put et on the end of a word?
Smaller,
less, cute, right? It is a signifier. It signifies the female version of the thing, the word that's right there. But instantly, we have a sense there's a value judgment that it creates. Last week when we were talking, on the very first day that I was having us talk about whiteness and class privilege, I talked a little bit about a term that's used in a lot of social sciences scholarship, I guess. I don't know how often this is used in sort of common parlance, but we talk about the unmarked subject. If you take a subject, a person, an individual, an agent in the world, the idea of the unmarked subject is that this is the one that is kind of the fallback universal one, right? So if you're talking about America's greatest author, you know, let's think about Faulkner. I don't know why, I'm a British scholar, so here I'm talking about Faulkner as the greatest American novelist. But we've heard that term, right? The greatest American novelist. You can quarrel about who that is, certainly. But often, when you notice conversations or find yourself in them or read scholarship on somebody like Willa Cather, contemporary, who is also a fabulous author, you will find yourself saying, you will find a writer saying, a great female author, a great American female author, right? That sounds familiar. We know that that happens. But it would sound very odd in our ears to talk about William Faulkner as a great male author. Right? I mean, it makes us giggle. It's like, duh. You know, there's this idea that that's redundant, but because we kind of figure that the male is the unmarked subject. We don't have to specify. So if we're going to look at a category outside men, we're going to specify the women, the female author, the female senator. You know, we're going to go around marking that. This happens in any social category where there are power differentials. Whiteness is the fallback race, right? We now have a black president. For how many centuries did we go around talking about our white presidents? You know?
Yeah. He's half white.
You wouldn't know it to read the papers, but... he's marked, right? He's marked because he's the different subject, the more marginal racial category. So we talk about African American writers. We have courses in African American literature where you don't just say we're going to have courses in white men's literature. Might be starting to be a possibility that we might do that. Because there has been greater attention in, I'd say, the last 30 years to the fact that this can happen so easily, there has been a lot of scholarship on those quiet subjects, on white privilege, right? It's easy for us to talk about diversity. You know, I was asked to be the diversity specialist or whatever this week. I said all week long last week, I'm not here to just say, isn't diversity neat and wonderful? There are people different than us. Yes, great, bless them, you know. It doesn't get us very far, you know. It sounds good, you know, the rainbow of humanity or the many-colored gifts of God, you know, that sounds all lovely and whatnot. But if we just say difference is good and here's us and people who are different than me, cool for them and cool for me that we're different, we ignore the fact that in our social fabric, these differences in category are almost always, there's a power differential. There is a power differential, and one is situated as more powerful, with more agency, with more centrality or value somehow than the others. So my approach to my 2 weeks of teaching here was to think to myself, if celebrating diversity doesn't get us much closer to understanding those different than us, even if we smile at people and say, yay, you're a pearl of God, too, I think that's how that sentence was supposed to go. I think that we are called by a biblical injunction to value the many-colored gifts of God or the manifold gifts of God by being called into relationship, into a healthy relationship, into right relationship with one another. And there are these things that language will do and that ideology will do that will situate us in not really right relationship with one another. And if we aren't thinking about it, you know, I have lots of privilege. I have skin privilege. I have body privilege, especially now that my ankle's working a little better. I can get around fairly easily. I come from an educated family. I come from a certain amount of money. Not very much. They don't give the pastors and the teachers of the world all that much in the way of cash. But here I am at Holden Village. You know, being at Holden Village, by its very fact, assumes a certain amount of privilege for all of us, privileges of time, privileges of money, in order to be here, even if we think of ourselves out there in the regular world as not necessarily having a ton. We are more likely to be haves than have-nots if we find ourselves in this place having this conversation. So I find it in my work really important always to try to mark all the subjects. You know, we all need to be aware of how we are situated in that social fabric. And if we are more self-aware, we are going to be better situated to offer respect and full humanity to those around us who might be different. And if we're kind of blind to our privileges, it's all too easy to kind of fall into just being okay with those and not really grasping what it is to be positioned differently than we are. And we don't necessarily grasp how painful it must be to have a bunch of people of privilege say, right on, you're different, cool, and not be able to do anything or reach out to us in a particularly effective way, because that doesn't bring us close to one another. And I think that's one of the things that we need to think about. How do we find ourselves in positions where we can see the real person sitting in front of us instead of seeing an idea of a person, because these things are kind of pervasive. Let's see. What do I want to do with these lists next? This is always such a fun and scary exercise. Where and how do these ideas, and I'm just going to call them ideas, these are just constructs, right? Oh, I know, I need to back up and talk about one other thing. Why do we know these are constructs? Because every one of us can name somebody who doesn't fit these categories at all, right? How many of you know a woman who is not demure? What? What? Oh my God! What has happened with our Venuses? Somehow not demure. How many of you know some women who are not emotional in some immediate stereotypical kind of way? Oh gosh, yeah. How many of you know women who are strong, silent types? Oh gosh, yeah. You know, all the hands are raising all the time. How many of you know women who are not talkative? How many of you know women who don't gossip? Yeah, yeah, sure. What's the male version of a gossip? Quick vocab test.
A barber shop.
How fascinating. A barber. Gossips and barbers. That's funny. That must be sort of the lost Shakespearean manuscript that never got produced. The male barber gossip. We kind of don't have a word for that. That word is feminized in a certain way. Does that make sense? How I'm using that? It's not that all women do it or that, you know, it's some natural biological quality of women. But in our culture, that word has been, so it's accrued a feminine tone and a pejorative one, right? Who wants to be called a gossip? No hands? Weird. Weird, wild, wacky stuff. Huh. Let's look at this list. I've already admitted that I don't have any babies yet, so we don't have to, you know, you might know someone else who hasn't had a baby. You know. How many of you know men who are nurturing? Oh, that makes me happy. I'm happy with a number of hands that many. How many of you know men who cry? Also happy about that, right? One of the things we want to ask ourselves and where our conversation ought to go after this hour is over, as we dine together and live together for another week, but we can't cover it all. We want to think about the implications of these expectations, right? There's a ton of fascinating scholarship and books out right now about boys and emotion, how to raise healthy boys, whole human boys. There's a lot of concern about that, right? Little kids, you know, we're all human, right? Humans are emotional creatures. Emotion is a critical, critical aspect of our being human. An ability to empathize with others is critical to our ability to be ethical in relationship with others, right? And if we have some idea out there that half of the population, we have this idea that's just been passed down, oh, boys don't cry, so we're going to tease them, or we're going to, because we're awkward with emotion as parents, we're going to be like, don't cry, that seems easier. You know, what are the implications of that for the world in which we live? What are the implications for our hopes for a world in which everyone's full humanity is not just acknowledged but respected and valued and used and drawn upon in order to make our relationships with one another and globally stronger things, right? How many of you know guys who can't fix things? How many of you know women who can fix things? Sure. How many women don't know where they're going? See what I did there? Yeah. How many women don't ask for directions? It's kind of awkward for anyone, right? You know, I think it's kind of a human kind of shared quality to feel a little bit embarrassed when you don't know something, right? That's just plain awkward. And if we make an assumption that women are happy to put themselves in a position where they look like they don't know something, what does that mean about what we assume about women? Oh, they don't know stuff all the time. They're good with that, you know. They'll go ask stuff. There's this idea that men know stuff, right?
And women depend on men to know stuff. Uh-huh. So therefore, they don't need to remember anything.
They don't need
all
to know.
All they do is go ask the men.
Yeah. Handy. It makes you wonder how I get by. I have these cats. They're sort of useless to me. Respect. There's a whole other list for them. They don't provide much for
That's
me.
Why you'll need more soon.
That's why I'm going to need more soon. Yeah, any minute now. Yeah, every year another cat.
Hoping to find the smart one.
Yeah, yeah, and by the time I'm 50, I'm going to be on that hoarder's show. And you'll all know, but that's fine, because I'm happy being embarrassed, because I'm a woman. So, anything else we want to talk about just on this list? How many know logical women?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. How many know women who are providers? My yes. Yeah. So, we look at these lists, we notice how easy it was to develop them, right? We're all chuckling, we can just rattle off, here are all the things that we know are associated in our culture's ideology with these genders, and then you start deconstructing them, everybody knows that everybody does all of these things, right? Almost every time every hand was raised. And so then, that gives us, first of all, a clue that these are constructs. These are not real, right? How many of you, this is a great question, know a woman who is all of these things?
Who's not inside a book?
There are some Victorians. Yeah, there are some Victorians like that. You know a woman who's all of those things.
Wonderful thing.
Oh. That's going to make me cry. Wow. As a teacher,
I'm taking notes.
It's important to know some stuff, isn't it? Yeah, yeah. Because certain people just count on you to know it. I feel like I want to ask some kind of question about this and this, but I'm not gonna. I told him that would be a little awkward. Well, these are not intrinsically bad things, right? You know, these are good words. Beautiful, nurturing, creative, talkative, right? These are great things. It's not that there's anything intrinsically wrong with these qualities in and of any one of them themselves.
Some of them are gossip.
Well, we talked about some of these pejorative terms. You're right. You're right. There's a string of really good ones. Then there are some that come along with these connotations that do situate women in some more problematic way.
You could do men are assertive, women are bitches. Mm-hmm. If you want to do that, you mean to...
Yes, exactly. Right. These become problems and issues perhaps in workplace studies and experiences, right? These have valences that are going to come up all over the place. It can be true that I think immediately of Lucinda Williams. I'm a music fan and follower, and she's a perfectionist in the studio. And she has been called a bitch about her perfectionism for a really long time. What do we call men who are perfectionists with their art? Artists! Perfectionists! Professionals! Right? Yeah, meticulous. Very positive connotations with that word, right?
Or assertive, yeah.
Or assertive, yep. So part of what I want you to take away from today's conversation is just to be a little more aware of how all of these words and their connotations kind of accrue and where they crop up. Because if we're more aware of them, we can, just with our language, try to readjust when the value is not right, right? If we're aware, we can stop someone when they're writing the review of the perfectionist female artist and calling them bitches, and we can call someone to account about that, you know, and say, where's that word coming from? Because they're meticulous, because they are a driven artist, you know? Let's note that. Let's pay attention to that. Let's value the things that are valuable and not use language to cut people down for things that we wouldn't cut someone else down for in a similar kind of fashion.
I think it's really interesting that, like, an awful word for a woman is calling them a bitch. And an awful woman you might use for a man is calling them a bastard, but in a way that's sort of blaming their mother because of the literal meaning. You know, when
yeah.
you think about it.
Yeah. She was a bad woman.
Yeah.
Hence you are
a bad woman.
Hence you're
like, I think that's kinda interesting.
That is. All kinds of, I hope your brain just kind of gets triggered all over the place for a while about these kinds of things, because it's fascinating and important. And something we can do something about.
Well, even little things like just when someone says, you know, a female doctor. Why do you need female?
Excellent. Yeah. Yeah.
Or male nurse.
Yeah.
Yeah. He's marked, right? Because the fallback position for nurses is female.
Yeah.
Right? The unmarked nurse is the female nurse, so then we call them male when they're in a profession that is not a typical profession.
Or nanny, and I heard manny.
Yeah. Yeah. The manny.
What happens when you mark an unmarked subject? I'm thinking, say, John Boehner wins the presidency next time around, you know? You go, we have a white president.
Yes.
But if you say we have a white president, the fact that you're marking an unmarked subject becomes a condemnation of the
already marked.
Of the already marked, it feels like.
How it feels.
Yeah.
I think in transition times, the feeling will feel strange for a while, but I think it's useful to note that a president is a white president, because then it points out that there might be other colors sometimes. Right? And if you just talk about presidents as presidents in an unmarked way until there's a black one, you make this assumption that they're always going to be the unmarked subject. It's the marking of something else that causes the power to be made visible. So in a sense, I mean, my short answer is marking would be good. You know, if we specify who we're talking about, a white president, that means something, right? It means something to have a white president. Especially if, you know, in whatever years in the near future, we've assumed, I guess, or lived with this idea that whites are the majority numerically, and certainly in terms of social agency and power. But if we're not numerically in the majority, whether a president is white or Latino or a female or black or something, all of those things are going to matter. But if we're talking about all of them equally and marking everybody, then we have a sense that everyone's a little bit on an equal playing field, that we're aware that we elected a white president.
So you would say then that you have a white male president?
Sure. A straight one? You know, you might as well start working now. Because at some point, you know, that's going to matter. But of course, we do still talk about, right, the gay politicians. They don't get to just be politicians. They're gay politicians for some reason. Yeah. Well, and there are a lot of different, I didn't mean to cover a ton of this today, but there are a lot of implications to the marked subjects as being sort of the more unexpected, the valued slightly less, sort of the in the pejorative category, because we often ask them to speak for everybody, right? Mm-hmm. You know, how many of us who are white are asked to answer questions, you know, what do the whites think about that?
Yeah.
What do the whites think about immigration?
How can we know anything about that?
I don't know.
Immigrated from some country that is...
Well, white. Yeah, that's a whole other road of... Bizarre. That's just bizarre. But yeah, it'd be absurd to ask white people to just make a claim for whites, you know, but we do that with all kinds of other categories, right? What's the gay position on this issue? Really? You know? Who is sending out those mysterious memos? They're not coming into my box. I don't know. My IT people haven't been able to figure that out. I don't know where the gays stand on things, because they stand everywhere, right? As do the whites, as do people who are living in poverty, as are the people who are wealthy, right? It is an odd thing to ask people to speak for a group, but when we have grouped them as other, we sometimes do that, because we feel like, oh, I know all about the unmarked subject, I don't know as much about this, so I'm going to ask what it's like, you know? One of the reasons I think studying literature is an incredibly important thing to do for all kinds of reasons is that I think storytelling is one of the best ways to get out of some of our strange ideologies. Instead of asking, you know, what do blacks think about X, you know, you can read stories you can find African-American authors who write memoirs or who write stories or novels or whatever, and we can encounter characters who are fully fleshed out three-dimensional human beings and aren't necessarily adhering to ideologies. And we can listen to the voices of people we don't always encounter. If you don't know what the gays think about something, you know, you can find a writer who identifies in some category and hear what that person thinks, and that's good, that's useful, as long as we don't make that error of thinking that this is what all of them think, because we know how foolish that is with the unmarked subjects, you know. Lord knows what all the whites think. I'm kind of glad I don't know what all the whites think. I wanted to bring our attention a little bit. This conversation will overlap very comfortably into tomorrow's in particular. I know these are all supposed to be standalone sessions, but we're going to be talking tomorrow about not ideology and constructs of masculinity and femininity, but we're going to be talking about biological sex and sexual ambiguity and the fact that there are bodies that are not just male or female, but there is also a range in between. And that, of course, has implications. These two issues kind of intersect. You know, if we all know men and women who don't fit all of these things, it's especially critical to be aware that there are human beings who are not even in these categories exactly in some simple kind of way. And if that's so, then we have to take really seriously how we interact with those ideological constructs, because we know that they're limiting to any one of us who might just have kind of the single biology over here. But if you've got people who are created by God to be the body that they are presented to us in, and that body is complex and richly gendered in some kind of way, And if that body is also one of God's precious pearls, what does that mean for us? What does that mean for us as people who don't just want to notice diversity but celebrate it? You know, what does that mean for how we look at anyone around us if we can't tell by looking at someone what their gender, their biological sex is? That's going to matter. And, you know, this, I think, is a conversation that is really critical in both directions, I guess. So we'll be talking about bodies tomorrow. Be thinking about where these are reinforced. We've all been aware of all the stuff in the news, especially in the last few years, about bullying. We've probably, all of us, experienced bullying at some time in our lives, but it's kind of made this big media splash lately, right? And bullying is the little kid not knowing any better, just trashing on all of the pearls of God because of divergence from some expected something. Any one of us can be in that position, right? Being on the chess team is a certain position in a high school fabric that can get you into some trouble. I'm just saying, I hear. But these are ways that, you know, when we end up sort of despairing over the fact of bullying, if we raise our awareness, these are things that we can pass on to our kids to be more aware about, those of you who have them. We spinsters will be, you know, buying larger and larger amounts of cat food. Eventually becoming buried. So,
I'm hopeful for the next generation of cats.
That's true, that's true. Until you go over that line and all of a sudden there's so many, they're just on top of each other. Like there's not enough oxygen and they just all start dying like in a red tide. Anyway, we're kind of out of time for now. I didn't really talk about the rich brother. It's a Tobias Wolff story. He's a well-known white male gay author. Did I get all that right? I don't know what his educational privilege is, but... And the rich brother is about a pair of brothers, one of whom is wealthy, and the other whom is kind of a ne'er-do-well and joins a strange religious cult in the mountains. It's so bizarre. What is this guy doing? You know, and his brother is really judgmental about that, and maybe you all have rich brothers out there who are judgmental about a place like Holden. But this guy is, you know, the non-rich brother is not many of these things. And his brother, who has some money, is really critical of him all the way along. But by virtue of how the story works, you get to the end and you wonder, has the author used the word rich in the title? Because you start out thinking it's about class, because the very first paragraph is how Pete has made his money in banking and has a nice car and all this stuff. But it raises questions about other types of richness. And, you know, it's an interesting thing to bear in mind with this type of topic. So it's not my task to just read you a story for an hour. So I point you toward that story and two other stories to sort of look at them with a gendered eye. Thanks for your attention.